Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Well, we have a lot to chat about with updates in FIP treatment, and we're chatting with the one and only Dr. Chris Byers in the house. Thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing, Dr. Byers?
Doing well, Dr. Christman. Thank you so much for inviting me to chat with you on this episode.
Yeah, no, thank you. And a little context to the listeners. Many of you have reached out to us about this discussion topic. So thank you for reaching out to us here at DVM 360. And so I said, well, I think I know somebody that can chat with us a little bit further about this. So to our listeners, about our wonderful colleague, Dr. Chris Byers. He is a board-certified veterinary emergency and critical care and small animal internal medicine specialist, as well as a certified veterinary journalist based in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Byers works as a teleconsultant in emergency critical care and small animal internal medicine for VetCT. In addition to speaking, he is an author, editor, and blog writer of criticalcaredvm.com with goals to educate pet owners and promote the triad of care, which we all love to learn more about. Okay. So, all right, let's get into this because, you know, historically, we really didn't have anything to truly treat FIP. I know to the new graduates out there, that might be a shocker to you, but for a long time, we didn't. So how has the recent advancements changed the way in which we approach the FIP patient?
Well, I think it's important to recognize we've traditionally focused on trying to be as accurate as possible when making a diagnosis of FIP. Obviously, a feat that is much easier said than done. But why this focus? Because, quite honestly, a diagnosis of FIP historically typically has meant euthanasia for the affected cat. And certainly making a diagnosis of FIP is anything but straightforward. So let's take, you know, a two-year-old cat that's presented for lethargy and hyporexia with weight loss, and the cat's PE showed variable pyrexia, icterus, abdominal distension. I hope we can all agree FIP is a differential consideration. I also think it's important to always go back to the basics we were all taught in school and think about other differentials. Now, thankfully, that list isn't really very long. We have septic peritonitis, neoplasia, pancreatitis, lymphocytic cholangitis, and certain infections, toxo, mycobacteriosis, for example. And yeah, there are other possibilities, but those are the big five in my experience. And of those, I would say neoplasia and pancreatitis are most common, while the infectious causes and cholangitis are less common. And hopefully differentiating sepsis is relatively straightforward because the affected cats are quite unwell and we can document intracellular bacteria in effusions. Now, the listeners may know guidelines from the American Association of Feline Practitioners use an analogy of a brick wall to describe how to make a diagnosis, with each brick representing a compatible piece of history, signalment, and physical examination abnormalities. So what are some of these proverbial bricks in the wall, to quote Pink Floyd? You know, being less than 3 years of age or greater than 10 years of age, lethargy, pyrexia, tachypnea. Also, biochemical changes like hyperglobulinemia and hyperbilirubinemia, and hematology changes like non-regenerative anemia, microcytosis, even mild neutrophilia. Now, when effusions are present, we expect a high protein count with a low to moderate cellularity. And of course, we all know we can run coronavirus serology and PCR assays to add even more bricks to the wall. And each brick makes the wall more complete, meaning one's diagnosis is more likely to be accurate. Another way to think about making a diagnosis of FIP is to think of each component as a jigsaw puzzle. And this has been described by one of our colleagues, Dr. Sam Taylor. So each compatible piece of the puzzle brings one closer to completing the puzzle to make a diagnosis of FIP, which we often describe as quote unquote highly suspicious, since there is no true perfect antemortem test.
Excellent. And just as a reminder to the listeners about the two differences of effusive and non-infusive, do you mind just sharing a little bit about those presentations?
So with effusive disease, we're typically talking about cats who have peritoneal effusion, pleural effusion, pericardial effusion, or a combination thereof, whereas cats with non-effusive disease have intense clinical signs that typically include those referable to the central nervous system, but there really are no cavitary effusions, or if there are, it's quite minimal, challenging to sample. But these manifestations have quite a bit of overlap. And so, again, if you have an effusive disease, it doesn't mean FIP. And if you have a cat that doesn't have effusive disease, it does not mean that FIP isn't present.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. All right. So let's talk about the treatment of FIP. So, you know, tell me a little bit about that and the recent approval in the U.S. And is, I'm just going to throw this out there too, is there one formulation that's better than the other for the listeners to understand?
Historically, treatment of FIP has included medications like prednisolone, interferon, and polyprenol immunostimulant. And as the listeners know, these treatments have been largely unsuccessful and often resulted in euthanasia. Our colleagues in the United Kingdom and Australia have had legal access to something called GS5734, more commonly known as remdesivir. This is a prodrug of GS441524 with an extra chemical side chain that is supposed to improve cellular penetration. They're really lucky. They have access to both injectable and oral forms, and there are established protocols in these geographic locales for each route of administration. In the USA, we currently have no FDA-approved treatments for treatment of FIP. However, Stokes Pharmacy, a PCAB accredited compounding pharmacy, has recently established an exclusive partnership with the Bova Group to offer a US-made oral treatment for FIP. So American veterinarians can now manage their FIP patients with Stokes Pharmacy's compounded preparation that is supported by Bova's unique drug formula that's been utilized in clinical research studies across the globe. Now, based on presentations, information, personal communication with individuals from the Bova Group and Stokes Pharmacy, emerging data suggests the oral formulation has similar efficacy to parenteral formulations available in the UK, Canada, Australia. Certainly, I expect studies will be published to independently address this issue, but it appears that the oral formulation is going to be a welcomed new therapy here in the U.S.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. And what's the mechanism of action, or how does it work?
Well, remdesivir is called a nucleotide analog RNA polymerase inhibitor. It's referred to as a protide, or a prodrug of a nucleotide. So put simply, remdesivir enters the cell where it is converted to GS-441524, which is the active form of the drug. This is the BOVA formulation. This active form prevents coronavirus replication by inhibiting the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase by competing with the usual counterpart, adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. So the nucleoside analog is incorporated into the generating RNA strand and causes a delayed stop in the viral replication process. Not to make the listeners delve too deeply back into probably year two of veterinary school.
Right, biochemistry. it's helpful in understanding that. So now that we have something in play here in the United States, how does this affect the guidelines that we usually follow, you know, when treating or, you know, trying to manage an FIP patient?
Well, the compounded remdesivir GS-441524 formulation from Stokes Pharmacy is a quarter scored 50 milligram tablet. So we're going to be able to do dosing to the nearest 12.5 milligrams. The dosing varies with the type of FIP upon presentation. That is effusive or non-effusive, and with or without ocular or neurological signs. So for example, patients with or without effusions, but no ocular or ophthalmic signs, should be dosed at 15 milligrams per kilogram of body weight every 24 hours, or that dose can be split every 12 hours. Patients with ocular signs plus or minus effusion get a little bit more, 15 to 20 milligrams per kilogram of body weight every day, or split every 12 hours. And the patients with neurological signs plus or minus effusion get dosed at 10 milligrams per kilogram of body weight every 12 hours. We give the compounded formulation with a small treat, or you can put it directly into the cat's mouth. We need more studies to figure out the effect of food on absorption, but right now it's recommended to give in a small treat or on an empty stomach, leaving a gap of about an hour or more before feeding a larger meal. And the cool thing is, this medication seems to really promote clinical improvement quickly. In the first 2 to 5 days, one should see an improvement in demeanor, appetite, pyrexia should resolve, and if it was present, there should be a reduction in effusions, abdominal, pleural, pericardial, etc. Any lymphadenomegaly decreases over several weeks. Now, interestingly, we know that effusion can actually get a little bit worse initially. So we do want to have owners monitor respiratory rate and respiratory effort at home. And since effusion usually resolves within a couple of weeks, 2 weeks, for example, we really want to consider a dose increase if it is still present at that time. We also recommend rechecking hematology and a biochemical profile after 2 weeks, and then ideally monthly, if an owner can allow. We expect hyperglobulinemia and hypoalbuminemia to normally improve over the first 1 to 3 weeks, but globulins can actually increase very early in treatment, and in some patients can persist until the 2 month mark, so 8 weeks, but usually by the 12-week mark in that small percentage of patients, it's resolved. The lymphopenia, the non-regenerative anemia can take 10 weeks to resolve. Some patients develop a peripheral mild eosinophilia, and there's thought that this may be actually a marker for disease resolution, and ALT can actually increase during treatment. How long is treatment? Well, oral therapy should be continued for at least 84 days or 12 weeks. And we like to confirm resolution of clinical, physical, hematological, and biochemical changes for at least 2 to 4 weeks before stopping. The owner, again, should closely monitor for clinical relapse for 12 weeks after stoppage of treatment. And ideally, we recheck CBC chem at 2 and 4 weeks after stopping treatment.
Great. I'm listening, and I was like, this is just, it's come such a long way with how we initially approached FIP. So it's great to hear that we have something. This is great. And how do you see this changing the way in which we manage, as general practitioners, for instance, the FIP patient?
I think our focus on making an accurate diagnosis, for fear of having to euthanize a cat, has changed with the availability of treatment. I really like Dr. Sam Taylor's analogy of a teeter-totter to describe our current situation. So on one side, we have a desire to confirm a diagnosis of FIP, but we all recognize that this could delay starting treatment, causing a cat to clinically deteriorate and could involve invasive and/or expensive testing. On the other side is the potential for making an incorrect diagnosis of FIP that leads to unnecessary treatment costs to the owner, potential adverse effects to the patient, and failure to actually treat the cause of illness. So, our job as veterinary health professionals is to find the best balance of ruling out, excuse me. Our job as veterinary health professionals is really to find the best balance of ruling out other reasonable differential diagnoses while not inappropriately delaying treatment. If we spend all of an owner's financial resources on expensive and invasive tests, they're not going to have anything left for treatment with the newly available compounded formulation of GS441524.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and when we're working up at the same time, when we have an FIP patient that we're suspicious of, I know that from an infectious disease perspective in our hospital and general practice, what would be some recommendations when you're suspicious of one because you're worried about maybe the next appointment, maybe another cat coming in? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what I would tell you is feline coronavirus is ubiquitous globally. It has a prevalence, depending on the study that you read, of 74% to 100% in the feline population. And it's highly contagious. It has a high rate of mutation. And yes, coronavirus can cause FIP, but in the majority of cats, it doesn't. And so coronavirus infection in cats really has a spectrum that ranges from really low virulence intestinal coronavirus strains that produce absolutely no noticeable clinical disease, all the way to a form of coronavirus that has unique viral factors like mutations of the spike genes that allow increased replication within monocytes and macrophages. But it's also not just viral factors that contribute to the potential of coronavirus transforming, for lack of a better term, into FIP. There are also host factors like immune response and genetics, as well as environmental factors like stress from things like neutering and living in a multi-cat household or vaccination, overcrowding, as well as maybe even the degree of coronavirus exposure. So, is coronavirus itself highly contagious? Yes, but most cats with coronavirus do not develop FIP, and there are several really unique factors, all of which we are still learning about, that contribute to a cat with coronavirus transforming into a cat with FIP.
Great. Well, fantastic discussion. And to the listeners out there, I really think this checks off all the boxes of what we were trying to figure out and get some further information on how we approach and treat our FIP patients. So Dr. Byers, thank you so much. And I want the listeners to know you have a textbook. Tell everyone where they can learn more about you, again, about your website, but tell us also about your textbook.
Ah, thanks for those questions. Yeah. If listeners are so inclined, I'm on all social media platforms as Critical Care DVM, and folks can visit my website, criticalcaredvm.com. I am really proud of the textbook edited by Dr. Massimo Giunti and me. We've called it Feline Emergency and Critical Care Medicine, and folks can check it out on Amazon.
Excellent. Thank you for putting that textbook together too. I put one chapter together, let alone a textbook. I can only imagine the amount of work that went into that. So fantastic job. Dr. Byers, thank you so much for joining us and all the great work you do in our profession, my friend.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And to the listeners, thank you for tuning in and for suggesting this awesome topic. Don't forget to rate this podcast as it helps us continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.